So we're just popping in before the beginning. This is the pre-beginning of this episode to explain a few things. It's been quite the ride the last few weeks, and you may have noticed that this episode came out about a month later than it was anticipated to. For that, I am sorry, but I also am fine with it. And I hope that you will be too. If you follow me on Instagram, you probably, you may have seen a couple of posts about my dear dad. He was taken to hospital a few weeks ago unexpectedly and has been in the ICU in a critical condition ever since. And as of this moment of recording, he continues to be in that situation, although after several massive operations, probably more stably so. So as you may be able to imagine, it's been a very strange and emotional time for all of us. And probably, unsurprisingly, the podcast took a backseat. But we find ourselves in this kind of limbo situation at the moment where Dad's doing better, but still in the woods. But I find myself incredibly grateful that he is still in the woods because that didn't look likely for quite a while there. So I'm doing my best to come back. The reason we popped in to say all of that before today's episode is that we recorded today's episode before any of this happened. And therefore you won't hear any mention of it because we had literally no idea what was around the corner.
Yeah, so some of the references in the podcast may not be as current as we thought they would be. We're releasing this probably a month after we were due to release it. So apologies for that in advance.
The other thing I didn't mention, I realized after we recorded, I think, is that, look, you know what? This is the balancing act, the juggle, the seesaw that I've been on the last month. I feel like a real shit right now talking about the fact that Care is open for pre-orders, given what the last month has entailed. So, you know, if you think that I am, then that's fine. I understand. But I have a job to do, and that job revolves around selling my book, which is due to come out in a few weeks in Australia and New Zealand. So if you are keen to get a pre-order of Care, you know, you can head to Booktopia, Amazon, I guess. Booktopia is doing signed copies. I'll be signing a few hundred copies there. Or if you're not in the position to do that at the moment, tell your local library about it or order through your local independent bookseller. All of those pre-orders make a huge difference to the way that the publisher and booksellers will support the book going forward in terms of promoting it and putting it front of shops and that sort of stuff. So if you're able to, and if you've ever wanted to support my work, that is one way of doing it. Otherwise, tell a friend about it or Instagram it. I don't know. And the book comes out on the 16th of June.
And for those in Germany, get ready.
Yes, actually, very excitingly, that is the first international sale of Care that I can confirm. That will be publishing in Germany, I think, like this time next year. So there's a little bit of a wait, unfortunately, but it is coming to my German friends. As for, and because I know people will ask, for the UK, for the US, for Canada, no word yet.
No one's reading books.
I think we talk about this in the episode, actually. Yeah. But people are reading books, but apparently publishers aren't buying books at this point in time. I will keep you updated as I'm hopeful that, you know, that we'll find a way forward there. And before we finish up today's pre-intro, let us just forewarn you that something new is about to enter your ear holes. After 6 years, 300 and something episodes, we have done it. We have changed the intro music, and I know that the intro music has almost as many fans as the podcast. And for you guys, I'm not sorry. I'm just going to ask that you are open-minded because The intro music for the podcast is a tune by none other than my favorite band, Shred Kelly.
You are so happy. I'm happy. It's so cool.
So it's a song unreal. Called Houseboat. It is on their album Archipelago. It's beautiful and I love it. And I know not everyone loves Change as much as you and I, Ben. But I figured after such a long period of time, Change was acceptable.
Plus, it's from your favourite band in the whole wide world. Exactly. So.
And if you like it, if you dig it, it's like just a little...
I like to think of it as, think you're around a campfire with your friends and someone's got a guitar.
Totally.
And they're just riffing and you're chatting and you're laughing and you're telling stories.
It's an atmospheric tune, is what I'll say. Yeah. But their music is dynamite, as long-term listeners will know. I am obsessed with their music, so go and look them up on Bandcamp or Instagram or Facebook or TikTok or wherever you find such things. And enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Slow Home Podcast. My name is Brooke McCallery.
And my name is Ben McCallery. I'm her husband.
You are. It's true.
Welcome back to the very sporadic podcast that, can you remember when we recorded this twice a week?
Back
in 2018?
Yeah, I think it was 2015, 16, 17. We did two episodes a week. Yeah, and like no seasons.
Yeah, it was just back to back to back to
back. I look back at that time as important. But very stressful.
Yeah.
And then we were like, hey, let's start a podcast network. That's not at all our skill set, but let's do it.
I know.
And that didn't work so well.
Only reason why I bring this up is I've never wanted to record podcasts more than what I want to do now. It's just finding the right time to do it.
Yeah. So you say sporadic. I say it was sporadic. And now the plan is to get back to a more regular schedule because... frankly, I miss it.
I do too.
We stepped back, as we mentioned in the last episode that we recorded, and if you haven't caught that, we do sort of go into why we fell off the face of the podcasting earth and where we are now, or at least where we were a month ago. And I think that hopefully that answers a lot of your questions about what happened. And moving forward, the plan is to record some really incredible conversations over the coming weeks that I'm really excited to share with you.
Mm-hmm.
And also to maybe spend a little bit of time, whether we do this on microphone or not, maybe recalibrating the seed of the show. So I don't know if you noticed, I didn't say our old tagline at the beginning of the podcast.
You didn't. I did notice that, and that's why I paused and said, I'm your husband.
Not because I don't still believe in what this began as, but my idea of home as a construct, I guess, has changed. It initially came about because I wanted to have conversations rather than write about things like decluttering and simplifying life and creating rituals and rhythms around the home that were helpful to myself and our family, but also to other people who were looking for ways of doing those things. And it did all of that. But over the last, it's been 6 years, almost to the day, 6 years since we released the first episode.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And also to you, I would literally have never started it without you. Just going to pause.
Is that you taking a drink?
No, that's our dog taking a drink. And if the audio sounds weird, we are sitting in our living room recording this because the room that we normally record in, our spare bedroom, is full of stuff from our son's bedroom, which I am currently repainting. So, we have our two doggy friends literally loud sniffing our feet.
And proud.
Exactly.
Circling our feet. So yeah. Apologies.
Cash and Joey
for the acoustics as well as the doggy sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not my stomach, it's the dogs.
It might be sometimes your stomach. Now, I think that my idea of home and what I want this podcast to offer is shifting. I don't really have the language for that yet. But, you know, I think for everyone last year changed a lot mm-hmm. of the way we see ourselves in the world and what is important and what we want to spend our lives doing and contributing to. And there may be a bit of a shift to include more of that in the podcast. Mm. I'm really keen to hear your thoughts, actually, you, Ben, but also people listening, on that. And whether or not, if you've been listening from early days, whether or not you have sensed that shift or would like to see more of a shift or less, you know, I'm really open to this. I'm quite curious, I guess.
Absolutely. I think first principle is just giving yourself a break and not really worrying about labels. And
that's what I'm trying. I am trying to.
And just let it happen organically.
Yeah.
I totally understand the framework and what you're putting out there. But... you know, we just got to wait and see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know for this.
There's a lot of stuff happening. And
is it?
Yeah.
Oh, slightly.
Manical. Yeah,
slightly hectic laughter there. Yeah. Okay. That's really a very compassionate way of looking at it, which I appreciate. And I think the conversations I have lined up already for this coming season are.
They're going to be great.
They're going to be wonderful. I'm really excited.
And are they all returned guests?
No.
No.
No. Okay. Some certainly will be, and that's on purpose. But there will be some new guests and people I've known. Yeah. Okay. I don't have the whole schedule sorted yet, but there'll be some cracking conversations and a lot revolving unintentionally but very happily. I think there will be an element of conversation about creativity and how it relates to intentional living and parenthood and what creativity offered people throughout the last 18 months, because I know for me it was like breathing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm. So there'll certainly be that
element.
Yeah.
Well, that's... I'm certainly looking forward to that. Why don't we start? We've got a whole heap of questions. You put some questions out on Instagram and we've got a whole heap of questions to go through. Hey, this is just like an old hostful, really.
It is.
To start this quasi-season, I guess.
Look at us trying not to use like constraining language. Look,
yeah. I, for the past 18 months, have really... I've been doing a lot of podcasts, a lot of podcasts, creating a lot of podcasts for clients. And it's so funny. It's all the advice I give people, we're not following.
Oh, like totally.
But if any people can forgive us for that, I think it's the wonderful Poggy listeners. But we'll get to these questions in a second. But I thought we'd take the first half of this conversation and just give a little bit of an update on what's been happening over the last month since last time we recorded. I know there's certainly some things that I want to talk about and share. But over to you. I mean, we discussed during that podcast your health.
Mm-hmm.
Mental and physical, and how hard that's been for you. What sort of updates do you want to share in regards to that?
Yeah, I have continued to investigate. I had a really rough time, and I can't remember if it was before or after we recorded last time. You're telling me it was after. That took me several weeks to recover from. That was probably about 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago. I was out of action for about 3 weeks, which is part of the reason that this season is scraping into April by the skin of its teeth. yeah, so that really was incredibly discouraging because it was something new that I hadn't experienced before. But putting my positive thinking cap on, it taught me a lot. Mm. I've learned some things about what's been going on with my body. I've learned some things that I can and have shared with my doctors. I've been doing a lot more reading and like just personal reading and trying to learn about what could be happening. And just today I've seen a doctor who has put me on a different medication that will hopefully help. I don't know. I feel like I'm talking very vaguely, but I don't have like a diagnosis at this point of what's been going on. I have a very strong theory, and the doctor that I saw today echoes that theory, that there's something up with my adrenal glands and that whole system. Mm. Something maybe slightly more sinister than adrenal fatigue, but we're experimenting at the moment with that. So like that makes a huge amount of sense to me, because I got really sick after I finished the first draft of Care,
yeah,
which is hilariously ironic.
The first book of Care that was rewritten.
That's right. I rewrote 1.5 times after that.
Mm.
But I did get quite sick, and that was the middle of last year. And I feel like it's been up and down since then. But every time I have some kind of crash, it is after a period of stress. Not even necessarily bad stress, just, you know, where there's more being asked of you emotionally or interpersonally or physically or whatever. So that's sort of where I've landed with that. And I have hope for the first time in a long time that we're going to uncover a way forward. Because if I'm, again, being honest, I'm really nervous about the rest of this year. I've got the book.
Is that
coming
because you're going to be busy and
So I have the book coming out in like 6 or 7 weeks, and I literally yesterday received the first draft of my first leg of the book tour, and it's intense. Mm. It's a lot less spread out than Slow was, and there's a lot of traveling and a lot of events, all of which. How lucky to be able to do them. I mean, how incredibly lucky to be able to even consider this. But it is something that takes a toll.
Yeah.
And I'm really nervous.
Yeah, you're doing the necessary work now before,
I guess, yeah,
that intense, crazy period leads you down severe adrenal fatigue where you can't operate. Like,
exactly.
Which was the case last year. So
yeah.
I think you're definitely doing the right things. And I wanted to mention this particular doctor's appointment, if you could ever call him a doctor. I'm
you're still mad.
I'm still so mad on your behalf for this. I'd never been with you to a doctor's appointment before.
No.
And you did some research and found out not only were you like muggy, you know, your head was sort of
foggy.
Clouded and, you know, you weren't
neurologically not able to
clearly.
Think straight. Yeah.
And so I was like, 100%, I'll be there. It was the first time you really ever asked me. And so just sitting in this doctor's surgery with you and having to hear from this doctor the belittling, is that even a word?
It is a word.
Belittling statements that he was making towards you and the questions he was asking you and the assumptions he was making was unbelievable and so disappointing.
Mm.
Now, this doctor was, I'd say, 70-ish.
Yeah.
And he had a trainee doctor there who he was talking to most of the time, like testing this trainee doctor and then going, no, that's wrong, da-da-da-da-da, basically like, how smart am I? And just even that model of learning, I think, is just like he was belittling the
trainee
yeah. and belittling you and then talking to me.
As if I was a little kid.
Like, this is what's like, I was just... I couldn't believe, first of all, I couldn't believe because I've never experienced it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out going, what else could I have done? And nothing. I just wanted to go in there and shout at him. Or really, like on the drive back, I was formulating a letter that I would write. But I haven't gotten around to doing that. But this is the thing. These guys get away with this bullshit.
Yeah.
And basically he said to you, this was his diagnosis, and you've been exploring all these, you know, seeing all these doctors, doing all you can, experimenting in the great Slow Your Home podcast way, experimenting with different ways of treating your condition. And this doctor basically said, you just need to stretch.
Mm. Yeah, strengthen your glute muscles and everything should really right should itself within 3 months. Because, you know, a lot of women have these weak glute muscles and that's often the cause of, oh, interesting. Do you mind telling me how that could impact my my brain function, how that could cause crushing exhaustion and fatigue, how that could give me a sore throat for 18 months. Like
it was incredible.
Yeah.
Look. And then had the nerve to charge $700 for the, yeah, for the pleasure, for the pleasure. Of that diagnosis. So I was so angry. I was so upset. I just.
On my behalf.
All, yeah, on yeah. your behalf. I lost all faith.
I'm glad that you were there because that is not unusual. That
which, again, I found incredible.
Yeah. I know for a fact that there are many people in our community, people listening, people who have emailed me, who are going through or have gone through similar periods of chronic ill health. And if they happen to be women or identify as women, they are, for the most part, shuffled off to the side, told that, you know, oh, look, of course she's you're tired.
She's
you
a
know.
Smart woman.
No, I'm a smart girl, apparently.
Oh, my God.
You know, told that, of course you're tired. You're a woman. You're raising children. You're working full-time, whatever. And pain, symptoms, real symptoms are either pushed to the side as just normal tiredness or immediately put down to poor mental health. And the number of doctors that have told me that all of this comes from being depressed. And I am open. I am open to any explanation. Mm. But when I tell them, I've been through depression before, and I absolutely agree that last year saw me in one of the deepest, longest bouts of depression that I have ever experienced.
Yeah.
I'm open about that.
Mm.
But I have been medicated for that and my mental health has improved.
Oh,
out,
huge.
Like beyond.
The fact that we're having this conversation is fact, testament
exactly.
to that.
Yeah. The fact that I haven't given up is yeah. testament to that. And I'm still experiencing all the physical symptoms and new ones as well, which is always fun. It goes in one ear and out the other.
Mm.
And I know that as women, that is something that is unfortunately not uncommon. Now, if there is anyone listening who has found themselves in a situation like this, there is a wonderful book called Pain and Prejudice that I've read. And it will make you angry, don't get me wrong, but it will also tell you that what you're feeling is valid and to continue to investigate what's going on. And I'm saying that from a place of privilege. Like, it's expensive, even in Australia where we have quite a good Medicare system. None of these appointments are covered by that or, you know, maybe 30% of them are covered by that. So I'm coming at this from a place of privilege. I'm able to afford just some of these appointments and medications and stuff. But if you are in a position where you can't afford it, go back to your GP, find a bulk billing doctor and don't leave until they listen to
you. Keep going.
Yeah. So yeah, look.
Sorry about that.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Because I know that you were really pissed about it on my behalf. And I appreciated that because I kind of feel like I'm losing my mind sometimes when I go in to see a doctor and I tell them what's been going on and what I've tried and what's worked and what hasn't worked. And they push it to the side. I really feel like maybe I'm imagining it all. I'm not, but it's a real head trip.
Mm.
So there's that. You know what? If you are someone who works in the medical profession, particularly if you're a man, we need to do better.
Yeah, just do better. Just treat people like human beings.
And I'm not saying all
no,
men
I know.
In the medical
I
profession,
know.
Of course, but...
But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say there's a certain generation of men who have been in that profession for a long, long time that have seen a lot of changes in society and they're just not getting on board at all.
Yeah.
And they're operating within this...
Bubble.
Little bubble because they're kingship. And
they're very knowledgeable. I get it.
They're experts. Yeah, 100%. The other thing that pissed me off, explicit. This is an explicit episode.
It is.
Is the way he was touching people.
Yep.
Like, and it was just women, like, touching them on the shoulder and on the back. And maybe I should report this.
You know what? I'm not going to tell you what to do, but it's obviously something that has stuck with you as inappropriate.
Mm. He didn't do it to you because I think
you
I was
there.
But anyway, my blood is still boiling over it. And, yeah, so maybe I need
to channel welcome that, to the club of blood boiling. Like,
yeah,
it's good to have you. It is. That sounded condescending, but I mean it.
It's hot in here.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people.
There is a lot of people and they're really mad.
Mm. So that's an episode that wasn't great, but I want to talk about some positive things that have happened over the last month.
Mm-hmm.
And that is getting a better idea of what your book tour is looking like.
Yes, that is very exciting.
And whether you wanted to share some of what that is going to look like and maybe some rough date. I know nothing is confirmed yet, but,
no.
You know, just.
Yeah. As of yesterday, I got a very sort of, fluid outline of the first stage of the book tour. Now, one thing I guess that will maybe be surprising or disappointing to some people listening is even though in Australia we are in a very fortunate position COVID-wise and my publicity team and my publisher and even myself kind of thought that by mid-year lots of places would be keen to go back to in-person events, bookshops and libraries and so on. And we've found over the last month that it's probably not the case. There's still a lot of places that are really nervous about doing that. And that's because, you know, we have minor outbreaks here and borders close and there's travel restrictions and whatnot. And so I get it. I completely understand. So that has sort of thrown us a little bit for a loop and means that as it stands at the moment, I'll be doing a couple of weeks of travel in New South Wales and Victoria and South Australia because that's where the events have sort of been given the green light by the bookshops and so on. So that is July. That's July. And I will be able to give you more dates once they're confirmed, obviously. Now, if you are someone in areas where I haven't yet been able to confirm events, I'm going to put my hand up to my publicist to do as many online events as possible. So if your local bookshop does those, you know, give them a nudge towards me or my publicist and maybe we can organize something there. But if you are part of an organization or you know someone or a group of people who would be interested in having a book event, you know, I'm talking like northern New South Wales, Queensland, get in touch because that's something that we may be able to patch together in a less kind of official
capacity. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I've landed with that at the moment. I am really excited because there's some brilliant.
So some rough dates?
I think like mid-July.
Yeah.
Through to the beginning of August will be New South Wales, sort of southern New South Wales and western New South Wales and Victoria. South Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll probably be looking at going out west, not Western Australia at this stage, unfortunately, but hopefully in September.
Yeah, okay.
So I've kept our calendar fairly free from the beginning of June through to the beginning of October. So that's kind of where I've landed at the moment. It's all quite strange. And up until last week, we didn't know if there'd be a book tour at all.
No. So it's I think it's amazing that there is a book tour.
Yeah.
Very blessed that that's happening.
Totally.
And something that I know you really look forward to and connecting with people. So I think the timing there is amazing, and hopefully it goes ahead. What about your audiobook? So you're recording that
next week. Yeah,
I'm heading. So there will be an audio version.
Mm-hmm. Read by moi.
Yeah.
Which is always an awkward experience.
Awkward experience.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, no news. And I know we got a lot of questions on Instagram about a US and UK
and European
release date. And unfortunately, there's no news
there. No news. I'm feeling quite flat about that, to be honest. I had hoped to have news of that, but I had also hoped that, you know, given that it's my third book and we've got such a beautiful community online, and that we did the very comprehensive US book tour last time. But honestly, I think that it's not a great time in the States and the UK publishing wise. So it's proving to be a little tough.
Challenging.
I have good people on the case. And if you happen to work for a publisher in any of those regions, let me know.
definitely, we will update you when we know more.
Absolutely.
But
and
so
I have
just
faith.
Nothing. Yeah.
I do have faith.
Yeah. Just nothing to report there at the moment. Hey, did we want to get on with a few questions?
Abso-frutely.
Okay. Let me open this evil machine called the iPhone.
Oh, all right. So hang on. While you're opening this evil machine called the iPhone, you've had a moment with your phone.
Yeah, I did. I had this overwhelming, it was a huge self-assessment, and this phone travels with me everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't come into the bedroom.
No.
And we've spoken about the importance of that. But other than that, it comes with me
it's
everywhere.
It's on your person.
Yeah. Even when I'm at home, and I got thinking, my computer rings when I get a phone call. And I get messages on my computer. So when I'm working, that's fine. Like I manage that. And when I'm not working, I don't need my phone with me around the house. So I just said to the kids, I want to be a better role model with tech, because I found lately they've been, and it's happened gradually, but they're very obsessive about tech and getting their tech time and making sure they get their hour or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want it to be this like reward.
Right.
So I just want to be a better role model in just displaying that tech shouldn't be part of like just around the house and every day. And I mean, it was really sad. In the morning, my daughter was telling a story and you had to tell me to get off my phone.
Yeah, it was
like it's just so terrible.
Well, it was just like I could see it was a muscle memory thing, but like we were literally
having
in the middle of a conversation
that I was part of, and then I just got my phone out.
And then like some noise kind of blasted out of your phone because it opened up on Instagram or whatever. And I'm like,
that's terrible. I feel really ashamed level of obsession has just crept into my daily life. So I said to my kids, I promise that I will not be on my phone in the house. I will put it in the drawer on the landing strip.
Remember that?
Yeah.
That takes us way back.
That was a great, so a landing strip is the place that you come in, inside and put all the stuff down on.
Yeah.
All your keys and phone and all the rest of it. But it's going to be in the drawer on the landing strip, and that's where it's going to sit. And of course, I will take it when I leave.
Mm.
And, you know, yeah, when I leave the house, it'll be there. But other than that, I can hear my phone. I can hear my computer. I can hear it call. So that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to experiment with it. Yeah. And just, I think that it will just be, here I am sitting with my phone, by the way.
To be fair, though, that is because I asked you to have it next to you to read the questions.
So it's your fault.
That is my fault. Absolutely. Blame me.
So anyway, that's my update on tech.
Yeah.
Tech talk with Ben.
Tech talk tidbits.
Don't start.
That tit goes bits. Out to Marty.
Tidbits.
I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciated that level of like self-awareness and self-assessment because I had mentioned to you I tried to be as gentle and as non-judgmental as possible because we all slip into bad habits, but it had been like a gradual but obvious spike in your non-necessary tech use, phone use specifically. And a couple of weeks ago, I think was the last time I mentioned it, until that conversation. And I guess it just shows that you can have these conversations with people, but you cannot force them to change. It's got to, like, that's my experience with lots of changes that we've made in our family, but also with things that you raise with me. Like, I'll get defensive or whatever and it'll sit with me and it'll piss me off and then it'll start making sense and then I have to arrive at that place of change myself. So I think people, and I know there's quite a few questions that are sort of related to this, you know, I'm afraid that my family won't come along with me.
That will be the number one question we will always have about slow living.
And my answer is really that you can't force your family to come along with you. If they're young children, you're in much more control of those choices and those decisions, and that is easy. But as they get older, it's important to allow your children, your partner, your siblings, whoever, to see what you're doing, hear about it, sure, but even more importantly, live the benefits of it. And over time, you'll find that often people will arrive at a place where they want to join you.
But if they're open and honest and up for self-reflection and want to learn and, you know, that they're going to come to a realization. And you know what? It may not end up being exactly what you want as well.
And that's really important. Yeah. It's important to be flexible with, like, to enter anything with a binary view or a rigid framework around what it should and shouldn't be is asking for trouble.
Well, that's not a relationship. That's not love.
There's no compromise. There's no flexibility. There's by all means, have your own boundaries and have them in place for you. But I don't think it's helpful to expect the other person in that relationship, whoever it might be, to land in the same place as you. I think it's really important to have that compassion and empathy and flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of leads into this question, and I'm just going to read. I won't be able to get through all these questions, but
I'll try my best to be faster.
Yeah. So this is from Edie Green. How did you find the slow life that worked for you rather than emulating the lives of every slow living author, podcast guest? Hey, thanks, community, for still using the word term podcast.
It brings me so much joy.
I don't use it enough, and I'm bringing it back. I'm stuck in self-care list mode, and every new story risks making me want to be someone else rather than me.
Mm-hmm. That's a really, really good, insightful question. I think
it comes back to comparing, though, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So no one else is going to have an approach that works perfectly for you because no one else is you. No one else has the same constraints, has the same inputs and outputs and history and stories that they're telling themselves as you. So as much as possible, try and recognize that. The way I tend to approach these things is with curiosity. Like, I've had phenomenal guests on the podcast, and I've taken bits and pieces from many of them to add up to my own personal philosophy. But I also think, look much broader than that. I think that slow living is a wonderful movement and I owe it so much in so many ways.
Yeah.
But I draw most of my personal philosophy from outside of slow living. So I guess to avoid finding yourself in that like shiny thing mode, you know, where this looks like a good thing, this looks like a good idea, and I want to try this, and that person seems to have it all together, and maybe do some work on your values first.
Nice.
Or on your, and I don't know if you have or not, so apologies if you have, but what I found and what I find is understanding my why, the reason that I wanted to slow down, what I was going to gain in my life by slowing down, which for me was mental health. It was family relationships. It was improving mine and Ben's relationship. Kind of tapping into those things that I wanted in my own life led me to begin to understand what my values were. And values change over time. So it could be that you're in a period of transitioning some of your values, and that could be where the, you know, the shiny thing syndrome is coming from, because you're trying to find something that feels right. But possibly doing some journaling, and if you have a copy of Slow, I do sort of walk through a couple of exercises that might help you to solidify some of those questions of what is your personal why. And for me, that then becomes the lens through which I view all of these ideas, whether they're slow living related or not. You know, is this going to take me closer to my why, or is it in service of my why, even if it's not directly aligned? Or is it taking me further away? And that is not foolproof. And like, I'm living proof of that myself. There's stops and starts and plenty of mistakes. But it is a way of at least removing some of that overwhelm and that confusion. So yeah, if you start with why and work your way back from that, something practical though that you could look at doing is going on a slow living social media cleanse. You can mute all the social media profiles of people who are adding to that noise. And it's not because you don't appreciate them. I won't be offended if I'm one of those people. Just quieten it for a while and see what you keep coming back to.
Mm.
Because I go through periods, like years, where I do not read nonfiction books for that exact reason. I find it overwhelming. And I find myself questioning why, like, what's wrong with me if this doesn't apply, or, you know, how can I make time for this thing?
Yeah.
When in fact it's not something I need to do.
Yep.
And it helps. So yeah, tap into your values, tap into your why, and maybe give your heart a break.
Oh, nice. On that, give your heart a break also. Just wondering whether, because you'd never want to completely cut yourself off from outside influences, because it's these influences that to a certain extent make you grow as a person. And so, yes, Brooke and I have fallen down the trap of looking outside and saying how wonderful this looks, and doing this looks yoga and all, you know, all this sort of stuff. Maybe just like a narrative shift and try to adopt the experiment rule where you give things a try. Like for me, it was journaling, and which I never ever did again. And it's okay to try, experiment, grow, self-grow. Like it's all part of it. If it doesn't work, you know, don't do it. But it's still important to sort of adopt different ways of doing things, because you won't learn if anything as a person or as a slow living master. Hey, trademark that.
You can.
We'll give a uni course in slow living.
Go for it. Slow living 101. I think an attitude of curiosity would be a really helpful shift.
Of putting it. Nice bumper sticker message. Hey, next question comes from Sugar Beetle. With the benefit of hindsight, how would you have changed parenting two small children?
Mm.
Sugar Beetle's in the thick of it with a 3.5 year and a 4 month.
Mm-hmm. You are in the thick of it,
and
my friend.
And is exhausted. Yep. I thought it was going to say 3.5 years and 4 years. And I was like, impossible. but
impressive.
Impressive Irish twins.
Yeah.
Can you remember when your kids?
Yeah, look, I can.
Oh, and then Edie actually has written also, me too. She has a 2-year-old and a 7-week-year-old.
Mm-hmm. 7-week-year-old. I remember that stage just. To be perfectly frank, I don't remember a huge amount of it, which is because I now know I was in the thick of postnatal depression as well as in the thick of really challenging time, taxing time emotionally and physically and mentally. So I feel you, and me of 10 years ago is right there with you. What's something that with hindsight, you know, it's a really good question.
While you're thinking, I'll just do mine.
Please do.
Mine was, I regret not being around you more. That was a time where, you know, you were basically sole parenting because I was just working like crazy hours, yeah, and just not having, other than the weekends, and that was limited to, I just wasn't around you and the kids enough. And my heart ached during that time. Mm. It really did. And it was one of the driving force to change the way I started to think about like my career and doing
success.
You know, exactly. The definition of success. And so I know it's probably not super relevant, but that in hindsight, the way that I would have changed parenting is just to be around more and to be able to contribute more, because I often feel guilty in that if I was around more, would have you struggled like you did? Would have you have had severe depression like you did? I don't know, but I do regret not being there more.
I don't know the answer either, but can I just say that what you were doing, what you were contributing, was allowing me the freedom and the privilege, because it is both of those things, to be at home. So we were in a position for a couple of years where I was able to be at home with the kids and not have to be concerned with earning money. I was working, but not in a paid capacity. So I know that you carry a lot of guilt around, but we have always been a team and we've always been pretty good, usually, at giving and taking as needed. And I think that I'm grateful that you felt the way that you did, because it did shift your idea of success and family and, you know, legacy and all that kind of stuff. So you wouldn't have arrived there if you didn't feel that pain. So it did serve a purpose in a hard way. But in terms of what I would do differently, you know, I think I used to carry around a lot of shame about my judgment of parents. So let me explain that a little bit. I think I remember saying to someone, it might have even been you, my judgment became a prison when I was parenting the kids really young. And what I meant by that was the same thing that everyone does. We think we're going to be good parents until we have kids. Like, I thought I was a fantastic parent until I had kids.
Mm.
And then you realize that it is tiring and a lot of the time thankless, and it's hard. Like, it's hard. And wonderful and beautiful and a privilege and an honor and all of that stuff, but it's hard. So I, for the first 2 years of being a mom, I think that I carried around this shame, and it stopped me from doing the things that I needed in terms of caring for myself and the kids and being present, because I had judged people for them before, you know, trying to think of an example. Like if I would see a parent at the park on their phone and their kids were playing and they weren't watching their kids, before I had kids, I'd be like, come on, how hard is it? Or like someone who's going for a walk and their baby's in the pram and they've got their headphones in, and, you know, I would never say anything, of course, in my head I'd be like, seriously, you know, be present, be there for your child. First of all, I didn't even know if it was their child, but I also didn't know if that was the parent's only 5 minutes of peace for the day. I didn't know if they were checking in on a sick relative. I didn't know if they were doing a mental health quiz. Yeah. I didn't know any of it.
Mm.
And who cares what they were doing? You know, so I would kind of live like rigid in those, not because it's what I needed, but because it's what I thought I should be doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I was comparing.
You were doing a lot of, I hope I'm not stuffing up my kids' lives. Like you thought like the things you were teaching them at that young age mm-hmm. would have like
lifelong consequences.
Huge lifelong consequences. Like I remember that being a huge thought in your head, just like, God, I hope I'm not like stuffing them up somehow.
Oh, and here's the real trick. We are. In some way, like everyone's going to hand down hang-ups to their kids.
It's the real trick.
It's true, though.
It's a magic show.
Yeah, ta-da! Yeah. So once I kind of came to peace with that to a certain extent, it was like going, oh, my God, yes, I can breathe. Mm. Yeah, kids are going to have something to talk to their therapist about. Like, but as long as those things aren't neglect, they're not, you know, abuse, they're not self-esteem issues, they're not, then it's okay. Like everyone's going to have shit to sift through as they grow up. Surprise.
Yeah.
So that was really helpful to me. But also, I know people say it to new parents all the time, but really let go of the idea of having it all done.
Oh, at that age?
You know, I'd be like, play with the kids once I've cleaned the kitchen. And then the kitchen would be tidied up and the kids are still happy playing out in the yard. So I'd be like, oh, all right, I'll do a load of washing.
Yeah.
And then I'll be happy if I could sweep the floor. And then I'll be happy if I can. And like I've moved the goalposts 17 times and the kids finally get sick of playing without me. And I'm still mad at myself for not,
totally.
You know, so... Yeah. It's fine, just, have goalposts.
So it's not setting yourself up for failure. That's
exactly,
the key, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And that has been a mantra of mine over the last few months. Don't set X up for failure. Don't set yourself up for failure. Don't set your kids up to fail. Don't set people up to fail, including yourself. And I guess that's flipping the switch on self-compassion and letting go of shoulds and expectations and stories. And I had to really let go of stories. I come from a long line of strong women, stoic women almost, where it was like you keep doing. You do and you do and you do and you do. And that to a certain extent has served me well, but it was also something that I personally had to unlearn to a certain extent because it became like a goal, an unattainable goal. As it turns out. And it's because we never had conversations about what the reality was.
Yeah.
We always put our best foot forward when we had guests or friends or whatever. And having those more honest conversations, saying, you know, how are you going? You know what? I'm exhausted.
Hmm.
Or I feel really resentful today. Or I gave my kids Weet-Bix for dinner 3 nights in a row or whatever. Hmm. You know, I think if you've got someone that you can have that conversation with as well, do it, because you might find that everyone's putting a bit of a mask on.
Yeah, those open, honest conversations are so critical. And slow living, as we're living now, as a lot of people like want to live like, it just doesn't work with kids that young. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like you need, it's just, for me, it would be an impossible task to adopt a lot of the slow living principles with a 4-month-old.
Totally. Like it's because just, you're at the whim of someone who...
So you
who,
just need to redefine what slow living is. And it's slow living light.
Yeah. Or it's like...
L-I-T-E, trademarked.
Lots of trademarks coming out of today's episode.
Get the lawyer on the phone, honey.
We don't have a lawyer. I think just to echo what you said, rather than ask yourself what it should look like to be living slow at this point in time. Ask yourself what you want it to feel like.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you want to feel like things are a little more spacious, if you want to feel like you're present for half an hour a day or whatever it might be, use what you land on as a lens, I guess, through which you can start to make a few small changes, flexible changes. That was a long answer. I'm
sorry. Don't move that goalpost. Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. I'm not sorry. Angela Polinsky, I'd love to hear more about applying slow strategies to the workday and workload while still being semi-productive and actually getting things done.
Okay, that's an interesting duality there. That
sorry, that was another.
Oh, someone else added that. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Meilin Kuring.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say that's quite an interesting duality where it was almost as though slow living negated productivity. and I don't think it does.
No.
And I think if you haven't listened to it, I had a wonderful conversation back at the beginning of lockdown with Louise Miller. And she is a slow productivity expert. And she's brilliant at it. So she has redefined what it looks like to work in a way that is intentional and slow. And I think that, honestly, that would be the best thing to do would be to go back and listen to that episode. It's probably about 10 episodes ago. But my line in the sand is that productivity and slow living, even in the workday, are really good friends, actually. And we just need to unlearn what industrial work has taught us.
Yep. Branch and Burrow write, how have you gone about putting down roots in a new town?
I think we've done a pretty good job of putting down roots in a new place. This is the place that I have felt the most at home, with the exception of Canada, ever. And that's a
shout out to the great white north.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a nice feeling. And by ever, I mean as, you know, as a couple, as a family, of our own unit. And I think that was an intentional choice when we moved here. We liked the size of the town that we moved to. It's only small, but there was and there has continued to build a real sense of community here. So it's been slow and it's been intentional. And I've had to grapple with like my own demons of belonging and introversion and loneliness in order to do that. And I've definitely made some missteps and I've definitely found myself coming up against resistance, which...
internal resistance?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So like I'd put myself out there when I'm feeling particularly energetic and only mildly introverted.
Yeah.
And then I would revert back to my more default mode, which is really like my own company, really like being at home. I like to not have too many draws on my time and energy.
Mm.
And that's just me. That's my mode of operating and that's how I operate best. And then I'd find myself in a position where I was spread a bit too thin for me. For other people, it would be like the most boring life ever. But for me, it's, you know, it's who I am and it's fine. So it's been kind of managing that. And I put myself up for a couple of community care projects. I volunteer at the kids' school, as do you. And I've gotten involved in a couple of community projects, which I am sort of really fluid with. And I knew that about myself, so I didn't put myself in a position.
You did manage the expectations though, with those people as well.
Yeah, so I didn't put myself up for like a rigid position on a committee or anything like that. I'm like, you got a working bee. I'm your girl. If you need someone to go and plant 100 trees, hit me up. But beyond that, I don't have anything to give right now.
Apparently you're a good writer as well.
Yeah. Sure, I guess so. yeah, so it's been really nice to kind of start to settle into a sense of belonging. I've loved what you've done since we've moved. In terms of forging some relationships with men in the community?
Some guys. Men.
No, but you've
it's
been...
men's group basically organized through the school, and we get together once a term to do a talk amongst.
So it's all guys, father figures, grandfathers, uncles, whatever.
Just a father figure, because research shows that if father figures are more active within a community, it helps with mental health. It helps with kids' mental health. It supports the community so much more. I think when I first came, the PNC was all women, and
which is pretty common,
very common. So yeah. You know, it's just getting creating a diverse. Makeup of support, community
and also
support,
sharing that emotional labor across
with
the community
dads
too.
And, yeah, so I've connected on a really nice level with a lot of guys.
Yeah,
and I think that's the best thing I've done. But it's also every term having an activity with dads and kids as well. So we went fishing last term, and
well, you dangled some rods in the water. I don't think anyone caught anything. Which again, wasn't really the point.
There was one fish caught.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
This term, there'll be a campfire, and we'll share some stories or something like that. So it was all based purely in what I learned when I did the mentoring program where we used to live. And it's just applying those same principles here. So do I feel comfortable in doing that? It felt just like the right thing to do when I came here. And so that's kept me busy. And then just helping out at the school. You have to put yourself out there. And I know you regard yourself as an introvert. It's harder to do.
Mm-hmm.
Where I am a weird mix of an introvert.
You're an ambivert.
I don't understand myself. If someone does, let me know.
I think you really share values of both.
So... it's hard work, but doing it early just creates a nice platform that you can then, you know, just keep at.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I've really enjoyed that. So they've been the best things. If you want to pinpoint some of the things that we've gone, you know, how we've actually gone down putting down roots, they will be the... That's the community aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
A question from Sarah Lynch. How has slow living evolved for you and your family during and post pandemic?
Another very good question. I didn't cope particularly well during lockdown. And I think that was a multifaceted thing, partly because I was trying to write a book about care and hope and kindness, and I was burnt all the way out.
Yeah.
And then some. And you were left doing almost all of the distance ed, like remote learning stuff, while also grappling with a complete shift in your business, and you lost a lot of clients virtually overnight, which, you know, in one way gave you the flexibility to be able to do a lot of the remote learning stuff and let me become a hermit and try and finish this book. But I kind of hit the middle of last year with a lot of hope about what we might all learn from the pandemic and from lockdown and from, you know, working from home and schooling slightly differently and, you know, discovering just how connected the world was and how isolating it feels as an Australian to not be able to leave your country and all that sort of stuff. And I had a conversation with Jade from Future Studying last week about this, and she asked if I thought that we had gone through the pandemic for long enough and it was challenging enough to create enough momentum for us to shift to a new normal.
That's a great question.
It was a really good question. And I said to her, I wish that I could say yes.
Mm.
But I think that there are a large group of people in our community, but also community more broadly, who are engaged with these kind of questions, who saw that the great working from home experiment opened up a workforce to people who previously were not invited to that workforce,
yeah.
People who live with a disability, people who live remote, like in regional areas, parents of young children, partners of fly-in, fly-out workers and shift workers, like these people had been largely excluded from
traditional work. Whether real or perceived, that unconscious bias.
Absolutely, but also just in terms of accessibility and their availability, and to me, there has been a huge conversation around that, not just with people that you'd expect, but also, and I know through your work, you've had lots of conversations with big organizations that are grappling with this and seeing that that is actually a benefit to be able to open up their workforce to a far more diverse group of people is of benefit to everybody. So that, like, that's one instance. And then I had a huge number of conversations with people about the importance of teachers and how incredibly hard they work and how unappreciated they are in the community, and that gave me hope. So there is that element to the community at large that is ready to shift and ready to use this as the impetus to shift and shift permanently and shift positively. But then I think there is a equally large, if not larger, group of people in our community that just want things to go back to normal, you know, where we can go about our convenience-led lives and settle back into that because there was ease there. And I'm sure there's a big group of people in the middle too who were confused by it all because they weren't busy in terms of going out and doing things. And maybe they found peace in doing quieter, slower things at home, but they also miss the other side of it. So for me, slow living hasn't evolved so much other than I actually think that it's become a more potent tool.
It's so, yeah.
I hope we can kind of use the language of the last 18 months to help integrate more people into the idea of slow living. Yeah.
Okay. Just talking about the corporates, and I was talking to someone very, very senior up in a corporate, and they were saying we can't and talking about the workforce conversation, which you mentioned, we can't afford to waste this crisis. I really liked that mentality, and that's my greatest fear is that, a lot of people are just going to go, no, we can just go back to normal.
Yeah.
We can just go back.
But normal is the problem, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Normal was the problem for the environment. Normal was the problem for people excluded from the workforce. Normal was a problem for, a lot of women who were excluded from the workforce or kept smaller in their inputs into the world at large because of the way that workforces were structured and childcare arrangements and emotional labor and all of that sort of stuff. I really hope that we don't waste it.
And it's probably one of my biggest fears right now is that we look back and go, oh, because of circumstances, we were put in this situation where we could have changed so much and we had the mechanisms, we had the tools.
We had the opportunity.
We had the opportunity to do it, yet we didn't. It kind of relates to this question that long stocking stables or long stockings tables?
Okay.
Asks on some tips to how to muster the courage to make changes. So she's worried that, I'm worried it won't bring the pace of life I'm looking for and cause problems in other ways. So tips to how to muster the courage to do so. I think this environment that we're living in is the opportune time to put yourself out there and to make like fundamental changes to the way you're doing things. It's And if they don't, and I think what happens is, and this is in my experience, and it couldn't might not be for everyone, is the more you make those courageous decisions, the more you want to make them.
Yeah. Yep.
You do one and you're like, oh, that felt good. And, you know, it could fail. Like, you could fail, but it's that mindset you get into.
Yeah, exactly. And that binary thinking of succeed or fail.
Oh, I know.
Too,
yeah, exactly.
You know, like that, yeah, that language which we all use is part of the problem, I think. Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And I think that there are very few decisions that we make that are unfixable if they turn out to not be what we wanted. You know, let's say you're like, oh, maybe I'd like to move to a place where, you know, I can have a yard. So that means I have to move to the outer suburbs or I move to the country or and you get there and you give it a year or two and it's just not what you wanted. Like, the pros and cons don't balance each other out and you decide that you want to shift, you can move.
Yeah.
You're allowed to move. I mean, I know, yeah, that's a very oversimplified view of it, but you can. You know, we're lucky because we can. Same with shifting the way you work or making a change to the way that you parent or, you know, most of these things can be incrementally changed or tweaked until they feel more easeful for you.
Yeah, right.
Not a word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I think maybe if you're terrified at the changes that you've got in mind, maybe like halve them. Is there a way to dip your toe? Is there a way to experiment? Can you go and stay in an Airbnb for 3 months in this place that you're thinking of moving and rent your place out?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, but think about an sort of an equivalent for whatever changes that you're looking for. And if you, again, going back to the idea of experimentation, if you view it through the lens of experimentation, you can't fail. You can just find stuff out. Go, okay, so I did this for 3 months and it didn't have the outcome that I assumed it would. Instead, this was the outcome. And how do I feel about that?
I'm not mad about it.
Exactly. Or I am mad about it and I'm going
and
to...
I can't believe I'm still doing it. It's been 3 months.
You know, so like kind of give yourself a big hug and then, you know, be compassionate with yourself and be gentle with yourself and be like, make it looser and more fun if you can, more like childlike almost. You know, when kids do things like, what would happen if I did this? Ah, okay, now I know. Yeah, I think, why are you laughing? Give yourself a hug.
I can't get out of my head. You know, when you said give yourself a hug, you know, when you were little and you used to like pretend you were making out with someone, it was your own hands like wrapped around your shoulders. I can't stop thinking.
You did that at school discos, didn't you?
Of course.
You like stood in the corner.
I'd be way too embarrassed to talk to
an actual girl. Just pretend to be. Oh, my God.
What's Ben doing? Oh, he's making out with someone in the corner.
He's in year two. That's inappropriate.
Well, this has got silly, so I think it's time to...
Is there any quick fires that I can do?
Okay, this is a good one because it relates to the dogs that we've had in the room while we've been recording this who are now snoring. Nicole Sladen writes, okay, this is random. It's not. It's on topic. I really, really want to add a dog to our family and I'm struggling with the environmental impact of that. Could you talk about your dogs and whether you have any tips on the issue?
Mm-hmm.
Environmental impacts of our dogs.
Yeah. So I think I put having like dogs or animals in your life in the same kind of category as travel in that...
Okay, this is interesting.
There are very obvious environmental cons.
Yeah.
To them. You know, and I'm sure you're kind of aware of what I'm talking about. I don't know if you can hear him snoring, but that's making me jealous. But the benefits to me of travel, the benefits of having animals in your life are enormous. You learn about the world, you find comfort, you find joy. You know, there are many things that make those experiences really worthwhile.
Mm.
So I guess it's our job to minimize the environmental impact, which I know is what Nicole is asking about. And for us, that is, well, I guess, first of all, starting with Joey, who's 2.
He's a pug cross beagle.
Apparently. We rescued him. Mm. We didn't rescue Cash, but to be fair, that he's like 10 and I knew nothing about the dog breeding industry and some of the pitfalls of it and whatnot. I would always go rescue personally now because there are so many beautiful animals that are looking for a family to join. And then in terms of like, there's a lot of waste that can come with dog food and like poo bags and all that kind of stuff. So looking for ways of minimizing the impact of that. And we've found a few. So when we rescued Joey, the people who were caring for him suggested just buying mince in bulk, cooking it up, grating up some veggies, freezing it in portions and using that as dog food. And we do that. So that cuts down on cans and plastic packets and all that kind of stuff.
It's in this really big tub.
Yeah. And then in terms of the dry food that we give the dogs.
That's what I meant to say. The dry food is in a real big tub.
It's in a big tub, but it's actually also a swap and go. So they reuse the container, which is like a 20-litre container of dog food or something.
It's huge.
And that's just at our local pet shop. So you just take your empty container in, pick up a full one, and they just reuse them. And then in terms of like poo bags, we've got ones that are compostable. Always pick up after your dog. And don't take them into national parks if they're not allowed to, all that kind of stuff. But we are, with our garden set up, planning on installing these like in-ground composting systems for things that you can't traditionally compost, like dog waste, meat, pasta, bread, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
'Cause we don't have chickens. And they will be able to be composted in those, but you can buy a setup that allows you to compost dog waste. We just don't have one.
Mm.
But, you know, I think that could be worthwhile looking into as well. So, yeah, short story, but there's things that you can do. And I think that there are...
The benefits greatly outweigh
negatives. That's my experience. And I know other people will have different opinions on that, but... there are things that you can do to minimize that and to also, you know, balance out that question, I guess. Yeah.
If you could just stop Joey from digging holes in the lawn would be fantastic.
Sure.
Minimize that environmental damage.
I'll try.
Thanks for joining us in what has been a pretty solid hit out for our hostful to kick off this season.
In terms of expectations for this season ahead, we'll be doing our very best to get episodes out to you every Thursday. And I guess I'm just preemptively asking for your grace on those weeks that we don't manage to, because we're trying our best.
Listeners waited 9 months for this season.
I know, that's what makes them absolutely awesome. So thank you for listening. I look forward to... being in your ear holes again soon.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.